It's the people of the Institute that are sort of with us whenever we're doing our work. They're sort of silently humming in the background, and that we are constituted by our colleagues.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. David Frank. Dr. Frank is a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Psychoanalytic Association of New York, otherwise known as PANI, which is affiliated with the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. He is also currently serving as the director and president of the board of PANI, which is one of the many IPA-affiliated institutes in New York City. Dr. Frank is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the NYU Langone Health Center, and he is also the chair of the medical center liaison between PANI and the NYU Langone Health Center. In addition, he serves on the board of directors of the American Association for Psychoanalytic Education, AAPE, and he is also a fellow of the American Board of Psychoanalysis. These activities describe one aspect of David's life as a psychoanalyst. But if you listen to today's interview, I think you'll discern, as I did, another side to the man. We learn that he's a musician, and an improvising musician, very sensitive to sounds. And he brings that improvisational quality to his work as the director. He orients himself to new circumstances, to new tunes, to new tensions, to new dissonances. And obviously, this time of crisis with the virus is a circumstance that required remarkable leadership. And what he privileges, and what I think has made his leadership successful, is that he privileges a sense of psychoanalytic community. And the way he characterizes it was to see that the members of his community have a humming in the background. And this is for candidates, this is for faculty, this is for staff, and in some way for analysts as well. This humming in the background consists of the caring, the holding, the support, the encouragement, the structure, the wisdom, the love of current and past members of this community. It is this musicianship that I hear from David in his work with patients, in his leadership of his institute, and his functioning as an analyst. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Here is my conversation with Dr. David Frank. David, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Harvey.
We know that New York has been struggling. It has suffered with some of the highest rates of infection of anywhere in the country, especially the boroughs of the Bronx and Staten Island. You live in New York, you work in New York. You have an opportunity to have a feel for what the city is like. I'm a distant member of the Institute. I live in Philadelphia, so I don't really know what's happening in New York. Share with me your eyes. Give us a sense of what the city is like, and then we'll talk about the life of the Institute.
Sure. As a New Yorker living urban in an urban environment, New York City is so much about the life of the streets. As great as the museums, the theaters are, concert halls, there's something about the energy and the sounds and the pulse of the streets, maybe the restaurants too, actually, for the same reason. It's the characters of the city and people outside looking into interior spaces and the other way around. So when the National Basketball Association sort of took the lead and stopped its season on March 11th, the city, you know, fairly shortly afterwards shut down and people relinquish their daily lives. New Yorkers respond. So the streets feel, the students are gone. A lot of, you know, the youthful energy, is not totally gone. It's actually popping up here and there now. But I mean, even the quality of, pre-COVID, walking to Trader Joe's to get some food, and a homeless guy would say, "Can you help me?" And then on my way back an hour later, he would say, "Now can you help me?" And there was, sort of quipping, and I would reward him. And now the homeless in the streets are angrier. There's a more desperate tone. And a lot of people have fled, for presumed higher ground or safety. So in some ways, it's like those old ghost towns in Westerns. It's inconceivable that this incredibly lively, diverse place that's just so filled with the energy of so many different peoples is... that now there's a refrigerator, morgue trucks on the landscape, and everyone knows about what's happening in the hospitals. So it's a bit, in the last week or so, the weather is a bit nicer, and it seems as if we're social animals. And so in the parks, people are there, bars have sort of window service, and the city's distributed some masks. Not everyone wears them. And I think part of it has to do with a kind of bursting at the seams sort of pent up desire to be with one another. So some people worry that we could return to the 1970s when New York City had a hard time. I was walking back from my office picking up some charts, and I saw some urban slang on a boarded up in front of a restaurant that had been boarded up. Urban graffiti, and it said, "We'll be aight." Urban slang for "we'll be all right." And I found that very reassuring.
Yeah. And in fact, we're recording this on Sunday, May 3rd. The numbers are improving in New York. The infection rates and the death rates are coming down, with obviously great uncertainty for what the future holds. But at least for now, the rates are coming down. Tell us about the Institute. You are the director of it. You have shouldered, along with hardworking faculty and administrators, the real task of turning this into, as other institutes have to turn it into a real online training program, not to mention an online treatment program. Walk us through the experience for you.
Well, the first thing was to sort of get our faculty and candidates to sort of close up shop in the offices, in the real office, not the virtual office. And it's such a part of our analytic identity that we work through thick and thin, that we're always at our appointed posts. And, in retrospect, one faculty member said it seemed like a no-brainer. But at the time, it was really hard. We are more accustomed to thinking than action. There's a television commercial for a bank in which a bunch of people are at dinner and someone starts to choke on their food. And a bunch of people are sitting around the table saying, is he choking? Oh, I'm not sure. Oh, he might be. I've heard of something called the Heimlich maneuver. Oh, how do you pronounce that? How do you pronounce that word? Mm-hmm. And they're debating this. And then suddenly, luckily, you know, another diner comes up and performs the Heimlich maneuver and saves the person. And the caption is something like, less talk, more action, or less talk, make it happen. And I think that analysts can be inclined to do that. But in this case, the National Basketball Association shut down on March 11th. And within a few days, we as analysts decided to shut down our offices and go virtual.
And what did that entail?
Well, I think it was most difficult for the candidates because candidates have only very recently begun seeing patients. It's hard enough to see patients and understand how to think about them and how to work with them in person. And here's this entirely new way of working. Our institute had been through a fairly laborious process of changing our frequency requirements so that our candidates, our students, could see patients at a lower frequency, 3 to 5 times a week, as opposed to 4 to 5 times a week. That process took a year to establish. And in a blink of an eye,
right.
Suddenly we're transitioning. So, and they were worried about the candidates, some of whom work in hospitals, were worried about their health, the health of their loved ones, and about their finances. And so we established a kind of rapid response COVID task force. And to set them at ease, we loosened a lot of the requirements for progression to the next class years. And we provided a bunch of video seminars. We invited the head of the candidates organization to our board meeting and our education committee. And she told us important details, even that instructors eager to teach online would enter into the Zoom video conferencing room right after the last class, ready to start the next class. And the candidates needed time and space that usually is at the bagel table in our institute at One Park at NYU, One Park Avenue. But so we took those concerns very seriously and also had to think about the balance of the poorly chosen phrase business as usual, going ahead with our curriculum and all of our readings. And we met with all of the current instructors to try to work something out where the current moment became more the content, the subject of each of the classes. And I think all of this was happening with, especially in the early weeks, the city was under siege. It did not feel as if there was any clear message from government. And it felt particularly important for the candidates that someone was in charge and had a roadmap. And I think especially it's hard to be a candidate, you know, it's sort of donning a new outfit and learning a new skill. For an athlete or a musician, sometimes you can overthink it. And then suddenly the world blows up and candidates are asking, how does analysis fit in when there's this dangerous, invisible threat that's a real threat? They're just starting to get their heads around how to work with patients with imagined threats.
The presence of metaphor and it can seemingly lose its power when there's real imminent physical danger. And that's, of course, the same challenge we face in the office. Though my sense, and again, we've been in this for, I don't know, 4 or 6 weeks now, is that the intensity of the focus on the outside and the literal is being integrated differently now with the more usual metaphoric analytic concerns. I don't know if that's your experience as well.
I think so. And I think this horrible experience with, you know, external reality being so frightening has called forth in many patients the therapeutic need of, you know, talking about the history of their lives in some ways through metaphor, but also talking about prior trauma and stress that is now, I think, more deeply understood in the context of the current setting.
And that's been a consistent theme in my conversations with analysts around the world about how they and their communities are encountering this trauma. Everybody points to that. They say that this is really an opportunity to rework old traumas without taking one's eye off what's real now. It's not a binary choice. It's you know, Freud's complemental series, that they always weigh against each other. The past living in the present, and the present also living in the present. And one could be agile enough to keep your eye open to both of those presences. And I think that's what we have to do.
Yeah. And also, I think in a way, it's been so awful in many respects, but I think that the coronavirus has given candidates a little bit more leeway and license and comfort in using their own personalities and instincts to be supportive. Sometimes in analysis, supervisors of students will note that they're being too supportive with their patients, meaning giving too much guidance or asking too many questions or talking too much and being too self-revelatory. And I think that what's emerged is that candidates see the opportunity to have a different type of human connection where they take that costume off for a while that they're sort of trying to learn to fit into and go back to their good original instincts.
And hopefully learn that from that greater nakedness, if you will, on their part, deep analytic work can then ensue. It's not that you then put your clothing back on and hide yourself. It's the presentation of the supportive you, the self-revealing you, can deepen the work if listened to and used in a deepening way, as opposed to let's keep this surface way.
Totally, Harvey. And because I think that good, deep analytic work, it's an improvisational craft for both patient and for analyst, faculty member, candidate. And I think that it's that flexibility to be many different ways that one grows into over a long time and over many, many years. And the learning curve, you know, I told our candidates, you're going to have to grow up fast, but now you have the license to feel more flexibility to be different ways with your patients.
How has it been for supervisors? Because they're now using electronic media as well, and they may not be as familiar with it as candidates are.
Yeah, we had, in order to help candidates over the past couple of years with their busier schedules and the stress of commuting, we had actually opened up some supervision to begin with pre-COVID to phone or video supervision. So I think we were prepared as an institute, and I think that's gone smoothly. And when we asked the candidates how they were doing, that was an area that they felt that the supervision was going well, and the supervisors felt was going well. Meeting together, the supervisors and the faculty having many more meetings together to talk about this experience and how to help candidates through it has also been really important for us.
And as director, you've really coalesced a community to hold the students, the faculty, and by extension, the analysts and the patients.
You know, Harvey, we had a terrible loss. The first, we have a faculty member just 3 days ago. The board meeting opened up, our board meeting, and this was announced immediately, unbeknownst to me. And this particular faculty member was had such a wonderful sense of humor and ability to integrate that into his his teaching and his supervision, and the outpouring from our community was so heartwarming. And I think it all helped us to see that as important, perhaps even more important than what we teach each other about theory and the conceptual work and how to think about technique, that it's the people of the Institute that are sort of with us whenever we're doing our work. They're sort of silently humming in the background, and that, you know, we are constituted by our colleagues. And I think that at both our candidates by fellow candidates and faculty members, faculty by fellow faculty members, candidates, and that it that's as important, I would think even more important, that who we are and everything that we learn about how to be gentle, firm, strong-voiced, more silent, sensitive, the ability to take things lighter, the ability to have depth, that it's all transmitted to us through who we learn from and who we work with. And I think that this terrible loss at this time, I think part of the outpouring was even more complex than about the loss of this person. It was also the grieving over the last couple of months of a community that we perhaps didn't even recognize just how important it is.
You know, you really added something for me and perhaps for many listeners with what you just said. Typically, when one speaks of how candidates learn to think as analysts and who's with them when they're practicing their craft, we think about their introjection of their analyst, which is, of course, true enough. But and then some people add, well, this particular supervisor, but you're really capturing something beyond that, which is the community. And your phrase humming in the background is really quite lovely, because it is in the background, always call upable as needed, and it's a humming. It's not a demanding. It's a centering. It's a sweetness. And it seems that the Institute has really performed that function quite beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, we're populated by all of these people in our analytic personalities, and sometimes it's sort of one of those voices will bob up, you know, sort of unbidden, and other times will conjure them up. But I think this is a discipline and a practice that requires a community. No one person can. It's an apprenticeship system, but that needs to be taught by many different people who stay with us.
Yeah. Talk to us about how this has lived in your practice. What has happened with you and your patients that this shared, both shared and individual crisis has made its presence known in your office, virtual or otherwise?
It's been very interesting, Harvey. It's first of all, the transition to video or audio. You know, one patient who was characteristically in pre-COVID days late and would attribute it to the subways or various external reasons, you know, sheepishly looked at him when he called in 10 minutes late, and he said, "It feels funny to be late." And it sort of illuminated, something was helpful about that. He saw that it wasn't externalities. Another patient, I tilted a little bit to the side. I must have been off camera. And he in a near panicky voice said, "I can only see a sliver of you." And it gave me a different appreciation for my presence. A couple of patients, one of whom with a history of depression, opened up the session. He was on the roof, which sort of sent a shudder through me. Then he quickly reassured me he was okay. He was just looking for a private space. So these situations, one, in the middle of a session with one patient, the patient just suddenly exclaimed, "She's replaced the premium sausage links." The patient was doing, worried about provisions, was at the computer at the same time as having her session, and we had a laugh together, which I think was therapeutic for her.
In the sense that you shared an aspect of yourself that she hadn't been familiar with? Is that what you mean by therapeutic?
I think that there was kind of an ironic shared sense that we were shopping together.
Ah.
I think there was something about that closeness that, you know, it suddenly we shifted into the real world that...
together, right. Together in the real world, right.
I mean, another patient, and this was early in March, a hospital worker.
And these are disguised representations, just to let the listeners know.
Very much so. This person who was going to be on a particular rotation in the hospital shared with me that she thought it would be best if she not come to sessions during that time out of concern for my safety. And that concern for me and my welfare, my well-being, was it illuminated a different part of her personality that was important to see, and I think has helped the treatment. Other patients feel that they literally demarcate the week by the conversations. I had one patient who lives alone and actually purchased a book on how to survive and thrive in prison. There was a revival of terrible feelings of being banished as a child to his room. And I think that he has more of a sense of the importance of that in his history and more continuity that has helped him. Several patients who, and it's calming down now to some extent, but who had outright panic attacks with terrible fears that they were going to, every morning, waking up that they would die of coronavirus, one of whom there had been a kind of almost a sidebar in when it had been spoken about previously of some childhood medical problems that were met with the parents by a kind of obliviousness and neglect. And this person texted me one evening, and it was very important that I see the patient in the act of having a full-blown panic attack. And we talked that night, and the patient calmed down. But I think it helped the patient to experience more of the continuity between the past and the present. And then the patient joked with me, asking for a supply of Alprazolam, put in an order for 600.
The visual comes up again and again, especially given, you know, the use of Zoom and Skype, and also that patients can carry their computers around and show you parts of their life that otherwise had just been spoken of, which, of course, can lead to deepening understandings and can also keep things just on the literal. It depends how one engages with it.
Yes, very much the case. I think there's also another aspect of this is that when patients ask, how are you? It reminds me of a Shelley Orgel, someone in the Panny Institute who died a few years back, wrote a paper on the patient returns in his later years that patients asking, how are you, had a different weightiness to it. And I think one patient told me, stay healthy, you're not fungible. And I think it highlighted for both of us poignantly that there is a certain irreplaceability and uniqueness of each therapeutic relationship. There's, you know, a patient could find every analyst or therapist on the planet, every treatment is going to be different. And I think that there's something about that, you know, the reality of our vulnerability, our patients, our own, that has heightened that sense of poignancy and intimacy in treatment, which I think has been helpful.
There is something more precious about the time we live in now for us. Which leads me to wonder with you if you would share something with us about what this period has been like for you. Everything is different, not to mention the enormous responsibilities you have for being a director of a large and thriving center. But even apart from that, your life is different. Everyone's life is different. What sustains you during this time?
I think a number of things sustain me. I think family, the importance of the intimacy of family life. When loss is in the air, I think it sort of supercharges that. And especially with all sorts of weird things happening with the flow of time. And one patient asked me, is time even passing? But with a sense that there's less urgency to do the next thing, go to the next place on the weekend, or I think it's opened up, it's sort of slowed down time, and it's allowed for longer conversations with people in my family and more intimate conversations. I also, there's something about the energy of New Yorkers. You know, there's this 7 p.m. cheer for the healthcare workers, and everyone opens up their windows. One of my patients sent me a clip. And he had a big pot and some kind of big spoon, and he was banging the pot, and he was exclaiming, "Dr. Fauci!" He's a New York Rangers hockey team fan. But I think clinical work and interactions with colleagues is stabilizing, and I think I often, people will sometimes understandably ask, "Well, how do you do it? How do you listen all day to people who are in pain or suffering?" And it's, now patients talk about a lot of things, but I think there's a energy flow in being in this very different space of inviting people to talk about their emotional lives that I feel it very much to be a psychoanalyst during this time and to help people and to be sustained in the process. And for me, you know, personally, I getting into an entirely different realm of experience for some time each day. And that, for me, that involves doing exercise, running. I play jazz music, and I have for many years. I'm a saxophonist, and having that time to, you know, enter into a kind of altered state of consciousness, which in some ways is also what happens in an analytic hour, but this is a different altered state. That has been deeply sustaining for me.
David, I want to thank you for sharing not only what it's like to be a New Yorker, but to be an analyst in New Yorker, and to be someone who's directing the Institute as capably as you are. I'm going to take away a number of things from this conversation, but what has lit a light for me is the humming in the background, and especially now that you mentioned your musicality, that has special meaning, and especially jazz where you improvise, that you undoubtedly hum in many people's backgrounds, and I'm guessing you have some very sweet music in your own background, because it comes across. Thank you for all you do for the Institute, for your friends and colleagues, and for sharing it with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Harvey, for your kind words.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.